In the next hour, we will cover topics and news related to visual digital arts in all its forms. Welcome to Digital Sites. We air every first Thursday of every month here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Stay tuned. Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Digital Sites. My name is Sausan Kadura, and I will be your host for the next hour. This month, we will first cover news related to colors. And most importantly, we will answer the question, can a company own a color? Then, in the second part of the show, we will delve into the world of emojis. You might not know this, but on July 17, it is World Emoji Day. So for this occasion, I decided to understand how and when these small, little, tiny digital illustrations started, and also cover a few news that were reported lately that are related to emojis. During the third part of the show, I'm going to cover a couple of news related to two new theme parks that will be opening in Japan. One is based on the Studio Ghibli animations, and the second one is based on the Nintendo Mario game that we probably all know about and grew up with. Two big companies are fighting for the color pink. Deutsche Telekom, which is a German telecommunication company, is the company behind T-Mobile, and Lemonade, which is an AI-based insurance company. Both these companies use magenta in their logo, branding, marketing, and so on. Magenta is part of their image. In summer 2018, Lemonade celebrated their new branch in Germany. But as soon as that happened, Deutsche Telekom's lawyers sent a letter to Lemonade demanding that they stop using magenta, which is basically a darker, punchier pink. Apparently, according to Deutsche Telekom, they have the rights to the color pink. Deutsche Telekom even succeeded in getting an injunction against Lemonade in Germany, which means they got a court order that will stop Lemonade from operating in Germany as long as they use this color pink. So Lemonade had to change its color to red on their German website to be able to remain operating in Germany. But the company vowed to fight back for their pink. They started a campaign called #FreeThePink, and they even filed a claim with the European Union Intellectual Property Office to invalidate Deutsche Telekom's attempted monopoly over the use of the color pink. Indeed, it's not the first time Deutsche Telekom comes after companies to defend their pink. One of their latest victims was also in 2018, when Deutsche Telekom came after a small British software company of no more than 7 employees to bully them into stopping using pink. So this raises the question, can really a company own a color?
Trademarks and copyrights are usually what people use to protect their intellectual property, but each protect a different type of intellectual properties. Intellectual properties are intangible assets, they are what we call the creations of the mind. While copyright protects artistic materials and works, such as books and videos, a trademark protects items that help define a company's brand, such as a logo, a slogan, or even a color. And while a copyright claim is generated automatically when you create the work, a trademark requires more legal work, and a company has to prove that what they want to trademark is indeed part of the signature and identity of the brand in the eyes of their consumers. So yes, companies can trademark colors, but usually there are conditions. First, a company has to trademark a color within its own industry. For example, a shoe company cannot stop a software company from using its trademarked color. These two companies are from two different industries and offer two different products. Second, the color has to be a very specific hue with a specific hex number, so a company cannot trademark all pinks, for example.
It is because of these two conditions that Deutsche Telekom is often criticized, because the company comes after everyone regardless of the rules of the trademark itself. Despite that, most companies rather change the color than deal with a costly legal battle with a big company like Deutsche Telekom. But this time, Lemonade seems to want to fight back, and the company filed complaints in various European courts to invalidate any claim Deutsche Telekom might have on the color pink in the field of financial services, which is the industry of Lemonade as an insurance company, but not the industry of Deutsche Telekom, which is a telecommunication company. While the legal battles over the color pink are not over, we already got an update at the end of last year. In December 2020, Lemonade won its first battle against Deutsche Telekom. A French court found Lemonade to be right and stripped Deutsche Telekom from any trademark right on the color pink in the financial sector, which is not their own sector. The CEO of Lemonade celebrated this first win by saying,
"In recent years, DT has banned the use of pink by a technology blog in the US. An aspiring watchmaker seeking crowdfunding on Indiegogo. An invoice processor in Holland. And a 9-person IT shop in England. That's nuts. When they tried to extend their monopoly over pink to the insurance industry, we felt it was time to fight back. If some brainiac at DT had invented the color, their possessiveness would make sense. Absent that, the company's actions just smack of corporate bully tactics, where legions of lawyers attempt to hog natural resources, in this case a primary color, that rightfully belongs to everyone."
It's important to note that trademark laws for colors differ from one country to another. For example, in 2019, an Indian judge ruled that a single color cannot be trademarked. This judgment came as part of a lawsuit brought by Christian Louboutin against a Mumbai-based company that was also producing shoes with red bottoms that Louboutin's shoes became known for.
What makes these shoes worth almost $800? Christian Louboutin is the mastermind behind these iconic red-bottom shoes. It's safe to say his footwear has stepped into the mainstream. Celebrities all over the world wear them.
You know, the ones with the high heels and the red bottoms?
These expensive, these is red bottoms, these is bloody shoes.
Louboutin even had the red bottoms trademarked. The signature Louboutin pumps start at $695. The most expensive pair? Nearly $6,000. So how did this craze start? Christian Louboutin had the idea for red soles in 1993. An employee was painting her nails red. Louboutin snagged the bottle and painted the soles of a prototype shoe. Just like that, the red soles were born.
This was a clip from Business Insider talking about Christian Louboutin's shoes, which red bottom is trademarked by the company. In Canada, before 2019, a color could only be trademarked in combination with a specific 2D or 3D shape, like the red of the soles of Louboutin's shoes, for example. Red alone could not be trademarked. It had to be a color on a specific shape. But the law eventually widened recently, and now a color on its own can be trademarked in Canada if the color distinguishes a company's goods and services from those of others in the marketplace. So what other colors are trademarked by companies and could get you sued if you use them? Designers, especially graphic designers who work on branding, should pay attention to this never-ending battles for color, especially by big corporations and companies. The pink of Barbie is trademarked by Mattel. Mattel is the corporation behind Barbie, the toy. The company had trademarked pink in over 100 categories. In the past, Mattel sued the record company behind the Barbie Girl song that you hear in the background when they used the pink in their art, like album cover. The court eventually ruled against Mattel and advised the different parties to, quote, chill.
Cadbury Silk. How far will you go for love?
The purple of Cadbury was trademarked by the company in 2004 in the UK. But Nestlé challenged the Cadbury trademark, arguing that a color could not be protected from use. Despite the argument of Nestlé, it lost in 2011. Then in 2012, a judge of the UK High Court ruled again that the public associates the color purple itself with Cadbury's milk chocolate. So the company was entitled, according to his judgment, to a registered trademark for that color. But the court's ruling did not extend to Cadbury's dark or white chocolates. Nestlé was not satisfied with this ruling and challenged that decision again. And this time, Nestlé won. In 2013, Cadbury lost its trademark of the purple color. The new judge announced that it would be unfair to give Cadbury the exclusive rights to the color. He added that a color trademark would give a competitive advantage to Cadbury and put Nestlé and its other competitors at a disadvantage. John Deere, an American company that manufactures agricultural, construction, and forestry machinery, has since 1988 the trademark on the yellow and green colors they use for their logo and branding. In 2018, the company filed a trademark infringement suit against Fimco, a maker of pesticide sprayers, when the company used green and yellow on its equipment as well. The complaint argued that the pesticide company attempted to associate its products with the John Deere brand in the public mind. But Fimco, on its part, argued that green and yellow are colors generally associated with agriculture. But the judge ruled in favor of John Green and agreed that Fimco's use of the colors on its products was likely to cause confusion among consumers. So far, John Deere asked approximately 40 companies to stop using its colors yellow and green. And so far, it has been successful in stopping these companies. But John Deere's have tried before as well to assert its trademark on the color green alone, not the yellow and green combination that distinguished the brand. But these attempts for the color green alone have been unsuccessful. There ain't no pain in the world that'll cover it. The heart. So what other colors have been reported to potentially get you sued if you use them in your design? First, the burnt orange of University of Texas, which allowed the university to shut down two apps in 2010 for using their color. The famous Tiffany Blue of the luxury jewelry company. The striking red of the retail corporation Target. The blue and white of University of North Carolina. And the orange of Home Depot, which is trademarked in the U.S. when used as the background for advertising, lettering, or other signage. And here it goes, the battle for colors in the branding world. Graphic designers and UI UX designers, you have been warned. Emoji by Brooklyn Queen. July 17 is World Emoji Day. Emojis are these small digital illustrations that over the years became a language used by people over the world to communicate feelings and expressions with each other, transforming an otherwise faceless and cold digital messaging system into a more humane, fun, and personable way of communication. For this occasion, I will talk about some news related to emojis during the second part of the show today. But first, let's learn a little bit about the history of emojis.
As long as we've been writing words, we've known that text doesn't always translate intended emotion the way we'd like. As quick text interactions became more common, we've discovered the need to denote what the heck we mean by what we type. The first person to fill this need was Scott E. Fullman, a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. On September 19, 1982, he suggested using this emoticon as a joke marker after someone posted a fake mercury spill message and other message board users mistakenly thought it was serious. Meanwhile, in Japan, a similar idea was taking hold called kalmoji. Kalmoji's origins are much murkier, but the general consensus is that the first kalmoji appeared a few years later in 1986 on a Japanese forum. Unlike emoticons, kalmoji are heavily influenced by manga and anime. They focus more on the eyes and the mouth and incorporate things like apostrophized sweat drops and slash-marked blushing. But emoticons and kalmoji are not emoji. In the 90s, the Japanese cell phone business was booming. Internet access and large color screens were already standard features long before smartphones came into play. As cell phone usage exploded in Japan, kalmoji naturally made the jump from message boards to text messages. Kalmoji were used to garnish conversation and make emotional intent more obvious and clear. This is, of course, especially important in a language like Japanese, where so much meaning is gleaned from context rather than exactly what's being said. In 1998, Shigetaka Kurita was part of the Docomo team working on iMode. iMode would become Japan's most widespread mobile internet platform and push the nation's cell phone tech ahead of the rest of the world. In the mid-90s, Docomo added a heart symbol to its pagers, and high school age users loved it. Kurita wanted to take this concept and apply it to cell phones. He wanted a simpler, more straightforward way to express emotion via text message. Not being a designer, yet being told to design the emoji anyway, Kurita looked to manga for inspiration. Kurita used sweat drops and tear waterfalls when creating his first set of emoji. Kurita thought Docomo's various cell phone manufacturers might polish up his emoji, make him a little bit prettier. Instead, they ended up using his work exactly as it was. Nonetheless, emoji took off. Unfortunately, Docomo couldn't copyright Kurita's emoji set, because each emoji was such a small amount of pixels. So, competitors took the concept of emoji and ran with it, adding more and more emoji to their products. Emoji were incredibly popular, unseating their kalmoji cousins. It didn't take long for emoji to start sneaking into the rest of the internet. Remember AOL Instant Messenger? I'm old. Years later, in 2008, Apple wisely gave Japanese people what they wanted with their iOS 2.2 update. Emoji. Japanese iPhone users finally had their emoji, but the rest of the world had to wait until 2010 for cell phone emoji to appear. It was then that emoji were added to the Unicode Consortium. Unicode is an international encoding standard for displaying characters on phones and computers. Once emoji were added to Unicode, Apple introduced emoji as a standard international keyboard option a year later, giving emoji a true international debut. Since 2010, emoji have exploded in use and popularity. There was a mosaic-style New Yorker cover. The word emoji was added to the Oxford English Dictionary. Twitter users have reimagined famous works of art as lines of emoji. Even Moby Dick has been translated into emoji. And of course, YouTubers have had lots of fun with emoji as well. Even URL links, which are used for internet websites on the World Wide Web superhighway, can be written in emoji. And that's all for now. What will the future hold for emoji? Who can say? All we know is that they are part of our history, culture, and the very fabric of what makes us human.
This was a clip from a video created by Tofugu called The History of Emojis. As you heard, first came the American emoticons and the more elaborate Japanese kaomojis. Both are visuals that use keyboard characters like letters and punctuations to make faces. It's only almost 20 years later that the small digital illustrations that we know today as emojis appeared. But how to make them work across platforms? How to make sure if I text you a smiley face on my Samsung phone, for example, it will also appear as a smiley face on your iPhone device? If your device uses different codes for these emojis, my smiley face might be translated to a puking face on your phone. This is why emojis can only work as a communication language thanks to a standardized coding system. Today, on all devices, the smiley face has the same code, the same Unicode code. It is the U+1F642. That's just one example. Every emoji has its own code. These individual international codes are created by the Unicode. So instead of having each individual platform create its own codes for these symbols, which wouldn't be compatible on other platforms that might have a different code for these same symbols, all platforms right now follow the code created by the Unicode standardized coding system. Unicode only creates the code corresponding to the image, the emoji, but the illustration itself is created by each individual platform. This is how, for example, the pizza emoji looks different on different platforms, but the code is the same. It will always show a pizza, but each device will have its own version of this tiny digital pizza illustration. That said, platforms can still also create their own emojis to be used only on their platform. For example, Facebook created a care emoji at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, anyone can create really an emoji and present it to the Unicode committee to see if it will be accepted. This is what Mark Bramhill explains in the next clip from the Washington Post.
Where was I?
This is Mark Bramhill.
Hello.
Mark moves through the world with the nervous energy of a small bird. And one afternoon, he found himself chatting with someone unexpected, an emoji expert.
He told me this thing that I didn't realize before. Anybody can propose an emoji.
Anybody. You, your mom, any of us could invent an honest-to-goodness emoji. One that could bother billions of people all around the world.
I was hooked. How was I not going to make my own emoji after learning that?
And he'd been tipped off to a concept that was already in high demand.
It was person meditating. Someone sitting in lotus position. You know, the one where you've got, like, your legs folded in that little crisscross.
Had you ever meditated before going into this?
Oh, no. No. I was just kind of doing it as a public service.
Mark, obviously, has a unique concept of public service. But to him, this was a serious endeavor. So he got to work. It's hard to remember the first time I used an emoji. One day, my text inbox was just full of saxophones and high-heeled shoes.
Emoji originated in Japan in 1998. This, like, little hack to send tiny pictograms. But if you didn't have a Japanese phone, they would show up as little, like, rectangles with question marks.
That's because there used to be a lot of competing ways to show text on a screen.
But then a few other people, they start this group called Unicode.
They're a collection of text engineers with the goal to create one international standard. Unicode could make sure every language would look right on any computer.
Anyway, Google wants to bring Gmail to Japan, Apple wants to bring the iPhone, but there would be this big problem if you couldn't do emoji.
So they ask if Unicode would adopt emoji in the standard, and Unicode agrees. This arcane group of engineers, they've become the gatekeepers to all the world's emoji. And now, Mark had to get their attention.
I think if you were to ask the Unicode committee, does yoga deserve an emoji? Probably they'd say yes, but you still need to go through these hoops.
The biggest hoop being a written proposal, proving there's demand for your emoji and that it hits their list of criteria. For example, it can't be overly specific.
Sushi's a good emoji that exists. If you were like, oh, I want a salmon roe emoji, that's too narrow.
It has to have multiple uses.
They want to know, is this something that can be used non-literally?
It can't overlap with existing emojis.
They want something that's going to break new ground. Not all the breeds of dogs.
No logos, brands, or real people.
They're constantly getting Batman and Starbucks. Those aren't going to happen.
It can't be a fad.
And for something that has been around for millennia, it is pretty safe to say it is not a fad.
Mark finishes up and sends his proposal to Unicode's emoji subcommittee. They do the first screening.
A week later, I got an email saying, we have decided to forward this on to the Unicode Technical Committee. I was just elated, and then also kind of terrified that, oh, now it has to pass muster with the big leagues.
At this point, most folks are done, and just wait to hear the decision. But a rare few emoji hopefuls take the option to go argue their case in person.
How do you say no to that? So when I got that email, it also meant, all right, I'm going to San Francisco. So it was November 7th, 2016. I went in front of Unicode. And honestly, I was just like a nervous mess. Before getting in my ride to go to this meeting, it was just like, I might as well practice one more time. So I turned on my recorder.
Okay, I'm really nervous. So my proposed emoji is for person meditating. This would be a single emoji that...
It was rough. I kept, like, forgetting basic words. You know, maybe that would have been a good time to be meditating.
At the meeting, Mark steps into a room packed with engineers. He takes a deep breath, checks his notes.
And then just like, all right, give your pitch.
And I think this would fill an important gap in the current Unicode standard. Thank you. Any questions?
There was some nodding of heads during my speech, but, you know, at the end it was like, okay, we'll need you to leave. And they took a secret vote as to whether or not to make this an emoji.
Any emoji that does get approved has one last step, a graduation of sorts.
Each company, Apple, Google, Twitter, has to draw their own version of it.
But Unicode doesn't really say what it should look like.
For the dancer, it doesn't tell you what kind of dance they're doing. It doesn't say if it's a man or a woman.
So each company has to interpret it in their own style. And when it's ready, release it into the wild with a software update.
And so a few days go by, you know, still hadn't heard anything.
Another day passes, and another. Until later that week, when Mark was scrolling through Twitter.
And I saw a thing about the new emojis that were approved. Looking around, seeing, like, okay, they've got a woman in a hijab, the hedgehog emoji, a man with a beard. And finally, I lower on the page, person in lotus position. I did it. I'd made it. I had created an emoji.
What was the first thing you did after you found out that it had made it?
I think I called my mom. You know, I've been seeing people tweeting like, oh my gosh, finally a yoga emoji. This is the only emoji I've wanted. My face just lit up.
When Mark first started his emoji, there wasn't a lot of guidance. But if you look at Unicode's site now, there are some good examples to follow. Suggestions on pitfalls to avoid. And right in the middle, you'll notice an immaculately typeset, extremely enthusiastic, very well-written sample proposal titled Person Meditating.
This was the audio from a video posted by Washington Post called Anyone Can Create a New Emoji, Here's an Animated Guide to Doing It Right. Aside from the interesting topic, I do encourage you to find the video and watch it because the animation is very well done. So if you're interested in animation, definitely check it out. It is on YouTube on the Washington Post channel. So understanding the application process to have a new emoji created and included in the Unicode coding system will help us understand our first emoji-related news of the day. While people use emojis to communicate all kinds of emotions, it should be normal for emojis to also reflect our changing realities, which are often marked by an always evolving society through our struggles and protests.
Overnight, San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick refusing to stand during the national anthem again. This time, he took a knee right behind hundreds of service members being honored on Military Appreciation Night. As the crowd and players stand, you can see Kaepernick kneeling on the sideline. Teammate Eric Reed joining him.
Going to stand.
And he's receiving heavy boos here.
The crowd booing every time he took a snap.
In 2017, when Colin Kaepernick kneeled during the national anthem to protest police brutality, graphic designer G. Lee designed a kneeling emoji. And to submit the proposal to Unicode, he worked with Emoji Nation, which advocates for more inclusive emojis. But after he submitted his proposal, he forgot about it. The application process itself takes 2 years. But during the 2020 Black Lives Matter protest, G. Lee remembered his emoji and looked it up and realized that Unicode did approve his proposal. But the application had its problem. He discovered that on all platforms and devices other than Google and Android, the quote, person kneeling emoji, which he applied for, is on two knees rather than one. It was a position closer to a prayer position or a sitting position rather than the protest position that G. Lee had in mind. According to Hyperallergic, it turns out that the proposal was too broad. Although the prototype image that came with the application clearly showed a person kneeling on one knee in protest, the description itself was not clear enough. Jennifer Lee, the co-founder of Emoji Nation, explains that, quote, in retrospect, the emoji should have perhaps been more clearly named person down on one knee. There's ambiguity in the word kneeling, but we had thought that the proposal image was enough guidance. As we mentioned before, anyone can propose an emoji idea. It has to include an image, but also a description. When the description was too ambiguous and didn't specify that the kneeling emoji was a protest emoji presenting one person kneeling on one knee in protest, this meant that every platform interpreted what the kneeling emoji meant. Many of them ended up designing a simple illustration showing a person kneeling on two knees, except Google and Android, who got it right. Now, G. Lee is still waiting for his original emoji to be approved as he intended it, And as I mentioned before, the approval process can take up another 2 years.
March 2020. 31 days the world is not likely to soon forget. It was the month that a new coronavirus that had infected tens of thousands in China became a global pandemic.
Emojis have to adapt to newfound realities and emotions. This was true in 2020, with the reality that the COVID-19 pandemic imposed on us and all the feeling it generated. Although in March 2020, Facebook added a care emoji reaction as an additional option in response to COVID-19, the current emoji lexicon didn't reflect enough people's emotions and reality, like, quote, being stressed as F, unquote. To respond to that, the design agency and Walsh designed a new set of 100 free downloadable emojis that can only be used on Slack, WhatsApp, and email. The emojis reflected this newfound and unique reality that people found themselves in 2020. The agency explained, "We're all going through unique, difficult times, and this calls for new emojis to communicate these shared struggles." Unquote. This news is an example of how emojis could be designed and used separately from what the Unicode coding system includes. In 2020, a survey done by Adobe found that 83% of participants wanted more inclusive emojis. The survey included people from 7 countries: United States, the UK, Germany, Japan, France, Australia, and South Korea. Only 54% feel their identity is adequately reflected in the current range of emojis. And only 37% of users with disabilities feel represented in the currently available selection of emojis. There are also generational differences in the opinion. 41% of Gen Z express desire for more inclusive emoji. This is comparing to 39% of millennials, 35% of Gen X, and only 30% of boomers. When we talk about inclusion, this does not mean only outside appearance. Culture was the leading category in which users wanted to see more inclusion. This includes cultural identifiers like everyday or symbolic objects. In 2020, Unicode Consortium added 117 new emoji. This included a piñata, an olive, a transgender flag, a bubble tea, and a roller skate. But this is not enough. Many of these objects are irrelevant to many groups, while other objects relate to them more but do not exist in the emojis selection. While emojis are used by people all over the world, the cultural representation tend to be Western-focused. In 2020, graphic designer Opleru Grobet designed 365 emojis to communicate the dynamism of his West African heritage. Opleru was frustrated with often inaccurate depictions of African culture and decided to create Zuzukwa, a set of hundreds of downloadable emojis representing West African culture. He said, and I'm quoting, "I noticed that most of the articles in the media about Africa were focused only on its bad sides and showed a reduced image made of war, hunger, and poverty. These elements are true, but it's not everywhere in the continent. So I wanted to show a different side of my continent through sharing our daily lives with emojis," unquote. His new emojis included a range of depictions of popular foods and musical instruments to culturally specific body language. For example, he had an emoji depicting the face of a person and that person with their finger that's stretching down their eye. This is a gesture often done in Côte d'Ivoire, for example, to say, quote, "I told you so." The designer explains, quote, "When you warn someone about something bad for them, but despite your warning, they go for the thing, and after they see that you were right." This emoji represents that very specific cultural gesture that does not exist in the West.
Yo, I don't think we should talk about this.
Come on, why not?
People might misunderstand what we're trying to say, you know?
But that's a part of life.
The final news is coming to us from a hyperallergic as well. While emojis today are a visual digital language that people use to express all type of emotions and feelings and realities related to their culture, identity, their protest and struggle, there's also a lot of people as well, they want to use emojis to express their sex life. Will that stop us, Ben? All right then, come on, spin. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. According to Hyperallergic, the sexual wellness brand Lilo has announced its intention to submit an application to introduce the first official, quote, sex emoji to Unicode. This decision was made after a survey conducted by the company showing that 76% of participants in the study said that they use emojis for sexting. But while 62% say they support an emoji hinting at sex, only 29% believe it should, quote, clearly portray sex. Among the participants, also 54% think there should be emojis that illustrate safe sex and sex toys. And that's it for the second part of the show that focused on emojis. Stay tuned. After the song, we're gonna move on to the third part of the show.
Subject to controversy. A three-letter word some regard as a curse. See, he may fiend and have a dream because he's seen a teen in tight jeans. What makes him react like that is biological. The scheme on getting in those jeans is diabolical. But of course he does it and she gives him rap. And before you even know it, they jump in the sack. As a matter of fact, sometimes it's like that. But anyway, ready or not, here he comes. And like a dumb son of a gun, oops, he forgot the condoms. Hey! Oh, well, you say, what the hell? It's chill. I won't get got. I'm on the pill until the sores pours and stuff pours down your drawers. Ew. He gave it to you, and now it's all yours.
Yours, yours. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex.
Theme Parks News.
If you like Studio Ghibli animations or Nintendo's iconic game Super Mario, you might like the next two news, at least if you happen to be passing by Japan anytime soon. So let's start with the first news. In March, a new theme park called Super Nintendo World opened in Japan. Despite the name, the park is actually heavily based on the Mushroom World of the Mario game than the Nintendo games in general. So if you are a fan of Zelda, for example, this theme park is not that exciting for you, probably. This new theme park is gamified and seems to have created a game-like atmosphere more than a traditional theme park with rides. The park also utilized augmented reality technology to enhance even more the immersive game-like experience. Next, I will play a clip from Gamesplain, which will give us an overview of how this theme park is designed to feel more like a video game than a theme park.
Hello everyone, my name is Robert Cefazon with Game Explain, and today we'll be sharing our review of Super Nintendo World with you. When you first enter Super Nintendo World through the warp pipe and exit via Princess Peach's castle, it truly feels like you've entered a small part of the Mushroom Kingdom. From the beautiful design, moving enemies, and more blocks than you can toss a Koopa shell at, it's a sensory overload. The park aesthetic is purely that of Super Mario Bros., and it works to tremendous effect. Every detail of the park appears to be expertly crafted, not by amusement park designers, but by actual game developers. This isn't a theme park, it's a video game starring you as the player. The minigames are what help bring the park to life, and everything feels like it genuinely belongs. The kinetic energy of enemies and characters naturally moving as you'd expect from a Mario game is pretty impressive. This, combined with the beautiful arrangements of classic Mario music on top of entirely new compositions, gives an immediate sense of actually being in the Mushroom Kingdom. No other theme park has combined interactivity with action on this scale, and it truly breathes life into the Super Nintendo world, transforming it from a simple theme park into a world of its own. Even the literal scale of Mount Beanpole was simply breathtaking, and to be honest, we were truly overwhelmed. The overall story of the park is that Bowser Jr. is up to no good, and in order to fight him, you have to collect 3 keys from one of the 5 boss characters. It's easy to have rides and cool buildings, but difficult to build an experience that feels like you're actually exploring a video game. It absolutely succeeds in creating an engaging atmosphere. After you've acquired 3 keys, you'll be able to challenge Bowser Jr. in the final boss battle of the park. Bowser Jr. has stolen the golden mushroom from Princess Peach, and we need to win it back. For reasons. Like the other attractions, the queue for this area is pretty cool. Featuring items like poison mushrooms, boomerangs, and clown Koopa cars, it genuinely feels like a place Bowser Jr. hangs out. The game itself requires about a dozen participants, so you can expect to be put in a rather large group, and is certainly the most intense of the park activities, requiring jumping, ducking, and punching in order to dodge obstacles and damage Bowser Jr. In a way, it felt like beating the main story in a video game, but there's still so much left the park offers. There are many other games that serve to increase the overall experience and fun of the park. As for activities inside rides, there are so many that sometimes we return to queues just to see them again and explore them in detail. Another cool feature were the augmented reality binoculars, with 2 pairs available in the park. These are really useful for finding some of the hidden Pikmin in the hub, and also display other characters and enemies through the AR functionality. It was cool for a moment, but to be honest, after using them once, they ended up blending in with the environment and just being used to enhance the experience aesthetically. Okay. Let's talk about what you've probably been waiting for. The rides. The main attraction is arguably Mario Kart Bowser's Challenge, and it's an interesting experience. First, the queue itself is amazing. It's presented as sort of a tour of Bowser's castle. The ride itself is, well, it's basically a rail shooter with a Mario Kart skin. The required AR headset is really what brings the ride to life, letting you see virtual elements like other racers and the Koopa shells that you launch. It's a cool experience, but may not be what Nintendo fans are expecting from a ride that sells itself as the closest Mario Kart experience that you'll find. One element I want to touch on now is what do you get exactly from exploring all these rides and seeing all of these activities multiple times? Well, there are 170 stamps to collect via the Super Nintendo World app. You unlock certain stamps by doing certain activities multiple times, or for example, if you line up 4 stars in the slot machine or 4 Tanuki leaves. There are so many stamps to collect, and some of them involve beating the leaderboard, and some of them are even visiting during the opening month of the park or visiting during New Year's. It will certainly take multiple visits once guests can actually access the park on a regular basis, especially if you want to collect all 170 stamps. Everything about the park is built to keep you in a video game mindset, and the design supports this very well. You'll be left wanting to see more of the Mushroom Kingdom, which is exactly the feeling this theme park should leave you with. From the perspective of a Super Mario Bros. Fan, it was incredible. However, that's also where our biggest critique of the park comes in. It's less Super Nintendo World and more Super Mario World. All of the content in the park, from the merch to the food to the rides, are all Super Mario Bros. Centric. But to be fair, this can also be seen as a positive. If other brands were already implemented, perhaps the park would feel less coherent. The atmosphere works well because of how focused it is right now. I even referred to Super Nintendo World guests as players because that's just how it feels when being in the park. While the impression other parks give is bringing content and imagination to you in the real world, it feels like we were directly brought into the world of Mario.
This new theme park from Nintendo is not the only Nintendo-related things opening soon. A Nintendo museum will also open soon in Japan. The museum will be in the same place where Nintendo, the company, started back in 1969 when the company was still producing playing cards. The museum is expected to open in 2024, and there are not much details on what it will include yet. The only thing the company explains is that it will include, quote, product development history. This probably means that it will include a lot of Nintendo's devices, like the iconic Game Boy, which was released in 1989 and which revolutionized handheld gaming. Going back to theme parks, there's another theme park opening soon in Japan as well. This time, it is a theme park based on Studio Ghibli's animation movies. Japan is in the middle of construction for their Studio Ghibli theme park. The announcement was made in 2018, and the work started in 2019. The first part of the park is expected to open this fall, and the fully finished park will be open by 2023. The theme park will cost 31 billion yen, and once it is completely finished, it is expected to attract over 2 million visitors annually. Next, I will play a clip from Park Hoppin' that will give us an overview of the latest updates that were revealed recently about what the park will include. And once again, you will see that this park is also not expected to be like a traditional theme park with rides, but more of an immersive experience.
I'd like to discuss what we know so far about the highly anticipated Studio Ghibli theme park set to open in Japan in the fall of 2022. This new endeavor was partially inspired by the great success of the Studio Ghibli Museum located in Mitaka in West Tokyo, which focuses on showcasing the work and animation techniques used in their films. Soon we'll be able to travel to the magical worlds of Hayao Miyazaki and Studio Ghibli. This entire project is also very different in concept from other traditional theme parks, with a focus on immersing the public into the distinct worlds and scenes featured in their beloved films, as opposed to thrill rides. The Studio Ghibli theme park is planned to be divided into five different realms, with influences from other films integrated throughout as well. The different lands are Springtime of Life Hill, or Youth Hill, which is based on the film Howl's Moving Castle and its steampunk style. This area will even feature a giant steampunk elevator where guests will be able to take in the view of the park from up high. This apparently will be close to the entrance of the park, and the area will also contain lots of 19th century themed accents and buildings inspired by the beautiful and intricate antique shop featured in the film Whisper of the Heart. Another land is the Dandoko Forest area based on My Neighbor Totoro. This area will contain Satsuki and Mei's country home from the movie, along with a beautiful rural landscape and a corner of the enchanted forest that the iconic studio mascot Totoro watches over. For this area, there will be walking tours and paths where guests can enjoy the lush scenery. The next section is the Ghibli Large Warehouse area. This unique design is intended for this section to be enjoyed regardless of the weather. In this large indoor area, there will be buildings inspired by Japanese and Western style, and will host various shops, play areas, exhibition spaces, and dining areas inspired by the Academy Award-winning film Spirited Away. Once the construction of those areas have been completed, work is set to start on the remaining two lands that are intended to open in 2023. These two sections are Mononoke's Village Area, a land heavily inspired by Princess Mononoke, which will feature a replica of Iron Town and contain elements from the Muromachi period, the time period from the year 1336 to 1573, which inspired the film. There will also be giant sculptures of the creatures and spirits that were featured in the film as well. The other land set to open in 2023 is the Witch's Valley area. This part of the park is inspired by both of the films Kiki's Delivery Service and Howl's Moving Castle, and will feature a small amusement park, and include a replica of Kiki's parents' house, as well as Howl's iconic castle. This theme park is definitely unique, with a focus on recreating the magical pastoral landscapes that are heavily featured in Studio Ghibli's films. This is an attempt to give the guests the opportunity to feel like they've actually stepped into the worlds that have been presented throughout the films. While I'm sure there will be rides of some sort, so far it doesn't appear that there will be thrill rides or roller coasters and the like, but rather attractions that will let the guests explore and enjoy the atmosphere of these magical realms. A lot of care and attention is going into the planning for this theme park so that it enhances and preserves the natural areas. This preservation theme is heavily presented in many of the studio's films. Hayao Miyazaki has recently come out of retirement to direct a new film, How Do You Live?, but he is also keeping a close eye on the development of this project. Even though it will be a while till the park opens, we can still visit these fantastic worlds through the films themselves.
And that's it for us for today. You were listening to Digital Sights. We air every first Thursday of every month on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. My name is Sausan Kadura. I was your host for the hour. Make sure to join me next month for more topics and news related to digital visual arts.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential.
message from the gouvernement du Québec.
In Quebec, vaccination against COVID-19 is underway, but not everybody is protected yet. Even if you've been vaccinated, you still need to respect basic health measures, like wearing a mask, maintaining social distancing, and washing your hands regularly. You must also get tested if you have symptoms and follow self-isolation guidelines. Find out about the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Follow all the health guidelines, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.